welcome David to my place here at Christie Walk, where I live. And I always say that Christie Walk is a beautiful place that's on unceded Kaurna land, and always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
So is my housing trust accommodation next door.
And you want to talk about the situation in Palestine and Israel?
Yes, tragic events of this last week require to be addressed. Unfortunately, there's been a history in misinterpretation of this struggle between these two peoples in terms of this event, that event, first event is the cause of the second event. That was known to the ancient Romans as a faulty logic. It's not like that. Two events, one after the other, are not necessarily immediate causes. Causation is anyway complex. I would say that what has happened in terms of the war between Hamas and the Zionist state is a war crime. I wouldn't say it was on the Palestinian side, because I expect most Palestinians don't endorse it, just as many Israelis might not endorse the shooting down of the Palestinian demonstration a few years back by brigades of sharpshooters armed with battlefield ammunition, which saw the blowing of the head off a little Red Crescent nurse who was tending to the fallen. They're all war crimes. The UN is considering proceeding against both Israel and Hamas for war crimes, but that's a very fraught and very long-standing and long-running process. I don't think what happened the other day in terms of the killing of Israeli civilians can be endorsed, and certainly wouldn't be endorsed by me as a historian or by the Australian Friends of Palestine as an organisation. We've always consistently called for a peaceful and just resolution in accordance with international law. The context essentially is that there are two peoples with a relationship to the land. One may be a less ancient one than the other. The Palestinian claim goes back to their residence in the land for 4,000 years, and the land was named after the people, not the other way around. And if you look at place names prior to the Zionisation of them and the removal of Arab names by the Israeli state, the ancient names of the place are in Palestinian languages. We've all heard of the Philistines. David and his army fought, are supposed to have fought them. That's a mythic reflection of clashes that probably happened. There were many peoples in Palestine before the Hebrew invasion thereof, which tells us, amongst other things, that according to Jewish myth, there were people in Palestine before the Jews arrived. Conquerors must have a prior population to conquer. It's logical. Jewish claim to... Actually, in terms of continuity, the Jewish claim is about a much smaller community, not quite so ancient, but you can't get too fussy about historical claims in the sense that not always legitimate logically. For example, Italians could lay claim to the whole Mediterranean basin on the basis of the occupation of it by the Roman Empire. You wouldn't want to take that claim seriously. So historical claims have to be assessed as cultural and political myths more than anything else. I'm not saying there's no real substance to them from time to time, but they are only things that have to be taken into consideration. They don't settle the argument.
Are there many places where the original people live?
Well, in the West Bank, for example, and in Gaza, There's a book by an historian, Walid Halili, The 4,000-Year History of Palestine. And he goes through a very meticulous review of place names in historic Palestine. I don't keep it on top of my head, but that's my source, essentially. This is a branch of scholarship that used to be known as philology. It was about language and setting in place and so forth and so on.
That's interesting too.
It's very interesting, and it's scientifically fairly definitive in terms of settlements in an environment.
So who were these original people?
Well, they're the people that called themselves and were called by others, including the ancient Hebrews, Philistines. You really need specific expertise in ancient history of the Near East to understand, to answer your question comprehensively. The ancient Hebrews in their Bible refer to peoples called Moabites, and there were any number referred to in the Bible of small peoples who had unique relationships to the land before the ancient Hebrews swept out of the essentially the Sinai Desert. So again, I can't list Halidi's references off the top of my head, but the place itself was a crossroads in the Near East. If you were coming up from Mesopotamia or coming down from Mesopotamia, and you wanted to conquer Egypt because you had the energy and no one was stopping you, you would go through Palestine. If you were coming the other way, you would go through Palestine. The Battle of Armageddon was fought between Egyptian and Hittite forces at a place called Armageddon, which was where the ancient Hebrews got the notion of a battle between all battles in at the end of time. Australians fought at Armageddon in the Great War in 1918 when Allenby's Egyptian expeditionary forces destroyed what was left of the Ottoman army in Palestine.
And was it since then that it was incorporated into our vernacular?
Well, no, it came to us into our vernacular through the Bible, through Christianity as a offshoot of Judaism. And the battle that was fought in 19 was called Megiddo. Now, Megiddo is obviously a corruption of Armageddon. So it's the same place, basically the same name. If you look on war memorials around the city, you will find Megiddo mentioned. The role of Australian light horse at Megiddo, as at Beersheba, was crucial. They were the battlefield expression of military mobility. The infantry were holding and blocking forces.
And what was Israel then?
Israel was a Zionist dream at the time. There was no State of Israel in 1918, and there was not until it was unilaterally declared shortly after a UN vote, but the UN had no authority to allocate Arab land. Israel was unilaterally declared by the Zionists in 1948 after they had begun an ethnic cleansing operation in 1947, and the declaration was made on the 15th of May, and the ethnic cleansing intensified then, and ultimately
ethnic cleansing of whom?
Of the Palestinians, of the Arabized descendants of the Philistines, if you like, who were Arabized in the 6th century, taking on Arab culture and Arab religion, namely Islam. Now, what happened in 1948 was the intensification of an ethnic cleansing already underway, and three quarters, which was about of a million, which was about half the Palestinian population of the day, was moved on and moved out by gunpoint. And that is essentially the birth of the city of Gaza as we know it at the moment, because most of Gaza, Gazan population, hails from the refugees who were moved out in 48.
And this was to accommodate the Jewish people who had been persecuted.
Jewish Europeans, essentially, yes. Not Palestinian Jews, Jews who had been resident in Palestine for centuries, going back into ancient times.
How did the UN get to do that? What gave them the right to declare
that? They had succeeded to the League of Nations, and the League of Nations had issued a mandate to Britain to form a protectorate to educate the Palestinians, including the Jewish colonists there, in self-government. What happened was that the British signed on for reasons to do with currying financial favour and Jewish favour during the Great War, and various Zionist officials were quite prominent, for example, in the great artillery crisis of the early days of the Great War. The chemist who produced new technology in artillery warfare in terms of chemicals, Chaim Weizmann, a senior Zionist official in the UK, did a lot of lobbying. Lord Rothschild did a lot of lobbying. And the Lord Balfour, who was a British government minister and much of an anti-Semite, actually, he wanted to see Jews moved out of the UK, wrote a note known as the Balfour Declaration, in which he declared that the British government was favourable to the formation of a Jewish home, whatever that meant, in Palestine. And the concern of the Palestinians was that they would be displaced. They wanted a guarantee that they wouldn't be displaced. So the whole mandate was very, very controversial. In 1936, there was what was called the Great Arab Rebellion, which was put down bloodily, and the Arab population, the Palestinian population, was disarmed. So that in 1948, when the Zionist militias broke out of their enclaves, they were armed, trained by the British, and were able to inflict themselves on the Palestinian population who were unarmed. So there was no resistance. There could be no resistance. There was very little resistance. Some bands managed to fight to the last man in the defence of this or that village with old rifles. One or two of them achieved heroic status. One Iraqi man who came down into Palestine and was a leader of such resistance as there was. But the ethnic cleansing was effected. It was put into practice. And since then, 67, similar operation, and the effects were similar too.
So that's how Gaza?
Gaza was principally formed by the descendants of the refugees of 1948 and 1948, and 1967, principally the 48ers.
So in terms of mass of land, does Israel have the majority?
It does now. It has effective control over the West Bank. The State of Israel controls as its proper territory. It doesn't accept that it has any specific border. And there are those Zionists who think that the State of Israel should go up into Mesopotamia, up into Iraq. But leaving those extremists aside, to go back to 48 as an indication, the UN partition conferred a majority of the land on a minority of the people, namely on the Jewish population, and the majority of the people, the Palestinians, got the minority of the land, and they were therefore not very inclined to accept what is going on. If Australia were partitioned and the Victorians were told to accept Australians from elsewhere, they would have a great difficulty being able to do that, and they might not be inclined to accept it either.
And were the Jewish people that were already there, were they incorporated into Israel?
By and large, I would say so. But again, the story's never one where one cohort of people, one population, one nation responds uniformly to everything all the time.
But before this happened, they all got on well?
Before the advent of Zionism in the 19th century, there's a millennial history of peaceful relations between Palestinian Jews and other Palestinians, believers in Islam, some Christians. Bethlehem is a Christian Palestinian city, or was. Israel has managed to reduce that population and its well-being sufficiently for there to be a real threat to that community now, which any number of Christian churches with links there will tell you.
It's a history you don't often hear about.
No, it's... Well, with respect to our media, which is a major institution of our class society and our conservative politics and the relevant state structures, you don't hear about history at all of anywhere. You hear of the 24 news hour news cycle, you hear received opinion, but you don't actually get information of critical quality. And information which is not of critical quality, which hasn't been interrogated and verified, is of no use to anyone at all. But it's very important in terms of generating, by propaganda, illusions, which people then live by because it's the only information they've got access to. But it's all there in books to anyone who wants to access it. Some books, insofar as they tell the truth, are a little more difficult to access than others. For example, there's a book by a journalist called Jeffries, who in the 1940s and just post-war told the truth about the mandate, that it was really being maladministered to foster a Zionist state in Palestine. For that, this man, who had been a Daily Telegraph war correspondent who liked Australians, was pilloried as insane and driven out of his profession as a journalist. But the book's still in the State Library.
Wow.
That's the only the one copy. If you go in there and ask for Jeffries, it will be dredged out for you and you can read what was the unspeakable truth in 1948 or 49.
And you've read it?
Hmm.
It's the only copy?
Yes. So it needs, really should be well guarded. Nobody should be able to have access to it without supervision, because it could very well be defaced or stolen. You get zealots who do these things. A book was defaced in the Bar Smith Library, for example, a few years back by Zionists for that very reason. They regarded the book as anti-Semitic, so they felt they were entitled to deface it.
Goodness. So it's never been a peaceful place, has it? Or since?
Well, a lot of history occurred with armies and regimes succeeding each other and being displaced by other regime armies. But a lot of it was sort of the machinations of great people and elites at the top and their armies. A lot of the peasants got on with life as it happened around the place more or less above them. So history can seem very violent or very passive and slow to evolve. It's in a degree a function of perspective.
So if we were doing this a week ago...
Yes.
We wouldn't have had the tragic events of last weekend.
On our mind, no. As I said, if it wasn't for this war crime, I would have emphasised the long history of the story as an antidote to the nonsense of the 24-hour news cycle. But something has happened in this last 24-hour news cycle, which is palpably real. The bloodshed is just too obvious to ignore. It can't properly be ignored. And so we've gone into commentary on that as well.
What do you think of the timing?
Of the bloodshed? Well, like a lot of military madness, it's not a creature of the moment. It was obviously planned for a very long time. Israel has Mossad, the most feared and one of the most professional and effective security services in the world. I believe a few people, a few perceptive intellects, even of amongst the Israeli military community, are asking the question, how was this allowed to happen? It's very suspect. You have to wonder if now that a war is being prosecuted against Gaza, whether or not this was allowed to happen as a casus belli, which is Roman for an excuse for war. You have to wonder if the bloodshed was allowed. But that doesn't obviate the responsibility of Hamas. But you can't identify Hamas with the Palestinian population. That would be racism. That would be to argue that an entire nation was somehow terrorist. You know, right down to the last individual, because of a handful of individuals. You know, you would have to say that all of Ireland, all the Irish people were terrorists on the basis of the work of the IRA. It's from a historical perspective, that's just nonsense. So you can't take that view.
But it will be the civilians who will now suffer.
Of course it will be the civilians who now suffer, as they always have and as they always will when war breaks out. So there's nothing to celebrate here. It's all about being realistic, understanding what has happened in critical terms and doing something about it. I have no time, really, or respect for Netanyahu, but if to put an end to this bloodshed, some sort of accord had to be worked out with him. That's what happens in warfare. War always leads to a peace negotiation of some kind on some basis. You know, fighting is, as von Clausewitz, the great military thinker, worked out in the 19th century after the Napoleonic Wars. War is unsustainable. It is such a high-intensity social activity that it can't be carried on forever. So sooner or later, people either have to decide that they're getting nowhere and they had better stop, or they've gotten where they wanted to go, more or less, in which case it's time to stop. So we need to intervene now, and the way to intervene is to remorselessly reject the 24-hour news cycle and the shibboleths and the prejudices and the illusions, and to call for immediate negotiations.
And who would broker that?
There have always been back channels between these so-called terrorist groups and Israel. They've had accords on and off for decades. So it could be done directly. It could be brokered by the United Nations. It could be brokered by great powers. China, for example. China is putting itself about these days as an honest broker. It hasn't been taken up very often yet, but the fact is that it's not had great power crimes to answer to in this region. So we don't, you know, I'm a historian, I don't have any crystal ball. I can't say how it would work out, but I can say that that some such plan of action is necessary and it's got all the force of probability and logic behind it. It's like telling who's going to win the Melbourne Cup. You know, you can't tell the name of the horse, but you can tell that it's not going to be a sprinter. It's going to be a stayer. And in this scenario, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And these episodes of war are episodes in a much longer struggle, which goes back to the 19th century. But it's not one that goes back millennia, such that people simply can't, because of the cycle of abuse, get along with each other. The track record is that they did before Zionism. So Israel needs to do what we need to do with respect to our indigenous population. It needs to come to an understanding, needs to negotiate an understanding, and when it's done that, the Israelis will have something much better than what their state has always gone for, which is victory. They will have peace, and it will be stable and it will endure.
Because I haven't lived long enough to see that.
Yeah, well, my father didn't. That was his last regret expressed on his deathbed, that he hadn't seen it. And Ilan Pappe, the great Israeli historian, dissident historian, paid me the compliment of saying that my father was a man before his time. He was my first historian. He, for example, if we're talking about deeds of blood, we must never forget the King David Hotel job, when the Zionist terrorist Menachem Begin, who later became president of Israel, or prime minister of Israel, and his Ergun terrorists blew up the King David Hotel, which was the venue of the British command in Palestine in 1947 or 46, killing Jews, British service personnel, Palestinians who were workers in the hotel. They blew up people of all ethnicities on the scene at the time. And it was, for many years, until Saturday, it was the biggest terrorist attempt in the entire history of the struggle. Now it seems to have been superseded, unfortunately. But in terms of extremists from the various populations having committed war crimes, there's no benefit to be got from saying, you did it before I did, or I did before you did, or your crimes are not comparable to mine. It may be that one side or another has committed more crimes of a certain magnitude, but there doesn't seem to be any carte blanche such that any one side has committed no crimes. And of course, as I say, as I repeat, you can't identify the work of extremists and terrorists with the populations they claim to work for, because they don't have that endorsement.
But that's exactly what's happening now.
I was in Italy when the Red Brigades were still operating, and I can assure you that the working class Catholic and communist didn't agree with and couldn't understand the killings done by the Red Brigades. The Red Brigades acted in the name of the people. The people did not embrace them.
It's a very scary world we live in.
It's been like this for a long time. It may be getting worse. On the other hand, it's always been a scary world in some regards. I mean, the fiction Game of Thrones is very much about aristocratic politics 101 and what aristocracies have done to each other through human history has been, well, they've been red in tooth and claw. So in some ways you can see it, whole populations have not been involved personally, but other populations, elites and so on, have been engaged in it all the time, going back millennia.